accession number 20596, reel 10.
Mr. Somerset, reel 10.
If you can tell me what you found when you got to the Western Aden Protectorate in, what was it, the late 50s?
Very end of 57, yes. Well, I found this situation where we'd got these advisory treaties which entitled us to intervene in the affairs of state up to a point. But first of all, that great sort of stronghold of the district office of the district office's great strength of in the native courts, of course, didn't exist. I mean, you had two sorts of court in the Western Aden Protectorate. You had the Islamic courts, the Sharia, but you also had the old Urfi courts, which administered the law before the time of Islam, because, as Godfrey probably explained to you, there were places in the Western Aden Protectorate, Islam probably didn't penetrate until about the 17th century. So you had a lot of pre-Islamic custom, and experienced officers like Johnny Johnson told me that when he was in Dathina, he did actually administer it. He was almost like a district officer there, because they had no sultan, which we call laughingly the Republic of Dathina. He said that he found that really he thought that often Urfi was more just than Islamic law concerning land cases and so on. So straight away you had nothing to do with either of these courts. I mean, in Dhala, the Hakim Urfi was the emir's father. The Court of Appeal was the emir. And I had nothing to do with that court. I wasn't concerned with even with the service of summons or anything. And of course I had nothing to do with the Qadi. So that was the district officer's powers. That he had no power over the courts, you see.
Were you based in Dhala?
Yes.
And what was your job title?
I was assistant advisor, the same as Godfrey. Godfrey was after me.
Assistant advisor to the
Emir of Dhala. I had the Emir of Dhala, and then there was a little sheikhdom up in the northeast, on the edge of almost on the edge of Yafai, called Shaib. The Sheikh of Shaib, and then an even smaller one, the Muflaha Sheikh, Sheikh Ghasim. He had an even smaller kingdom, more or less between Shaib and Dhala. And my arrival in Dhala was the assistant advisor up there was a chap called Mohammed Farid, and about a mile and a half south of my house, he pointed down what we call the Derrigo, a very sort of steep track, and he said, "We haven't been down there since the Camerons were ambushed. They'd lost a couple of men or something down there." And I found that more than half the emirate was a no-go area.
For whom?
For me. Because the dissidents had taken over. I mean, coming from Nigeria, this was... I can't go into the area. I can't interfere in the courts. On the other hand, I had... when I did go out, I normally had a patrol of at least 20 men with me, you know, my government guards. And I had a garrison of about 40, I suppose, Dhala, of guards. I had in support of me a battalion of Aden Protected Levies, a company of British troops, a troop of armoured cars, a troop of mountain guns, and I had at my door an RAF intelligence officer who could whistle up a brace of hunters to... No, they weren't hunters in there, they were Venoms, they were called. You know, we had considerable military force, not under my command, but sort of to support me, but I wasn't allowed to go where I might have wished to go. I mean, I couldn't sort of tour as I had done in Nigeria. Furthermore, if I did tour, it wouldn't have done me any good, because you couldn't have a village meeting in Arabia, I discovered. It wasn't that... All governments in Arabia seem to be whispering. People went and whispered to the emir. It's very... Compared with dealing with Igbos, it's, as I say, it was a cultural shock. Call an Igbo village meeting, everybody turns out, and they're very free with their tongue. They tell you what they think. Can't find out what people think in Arabia.
So it was an autocracy?
Yeah, a pretty feeble one.
Who were these dissidents?
Well, they were people who were anti the emir. But you see, they'd been... If you read the section on Dala in tribes in the vicinity of Aden, you'll find that the political agent and a company of Sikhs climbed the Jebel Dahaf and were fired on by dissidents or tribesmen of the Zindani faction. Well, 70 years later, when I went up the Jebel Dahaf, I likewise was fired on by dissidents of the Zindani faction, you see, because the tribal life in the Western Aden Protectorate is sort of made up of two sides. Ever will be, I suppose, unless some greater force comes along and says you're going to stop fighting. The situation in Dala, I think, made slightly worse by the Emir Haider. Did Godfrey mention him?
I can't remember.
Well, the Emir Haider was Sharfel's predecessor. I'm not quite sure exactly what relation he was, uncle or something something like that. I mean, he was the same family, of course, as the Dola. Now, the Emir Haider really had been an autocrat and had taken people's land. And when Haider was kicked out, for reasons which I don't understand, the officer then in Dala said that the land you got, there were two sorts of land. You've got land which really belonged to the ruling family, and you got the land which Haider had stolen, and that land was to become lands of the Beit al-Mal. They were treasury, state land. No attempt seemed to have been made to distribute this land to... No distinction being made between the lands which belonged to the emir and the lands that belonged to the Beit al-Mal. And I said to the emir after the Jahaf business, which we'll come on to in a moment, oughtn't we to... Now we've got lots of money because the Federation started. Oughtn't we to return the lands which Haider stole to their original owners? And his reply to this was, well, he said, do you propose that all these people should go off to the Yemen and get a certificate from Haider that he stole their land? It's a very good sort of Arab way of... making the point. Anyway, he was Sharfel, was a close-fisted sort of fellow, and I wouldn't propose, no intention of letting go of anything that he'd got his hands on. But I always felt that this was a an irritant, these lands of the Beit al-Mal, that sort of could have been ironed out. But I doubt whether I'd have got any support from Aidan if I'd pressed the matter. I think that Trevascus at that date was much more concerned of putting the Federation together, and he'd have said no, come on, there were more important matters than that. As I say, the Emir himself was dead against the idea, but I thought that this was a point. I don't know whether did Godfrey mention it? Did it come up?
In I cannot remember.
No. I thought it was it. One of my early experiences in Dala, which did go right, was the Emir, rather to my surprise, invited me to look at his treasury, because I was warned by Trevascus that you didn't just move into a division and do the obvious thing, just sort of first morning check the treasury and see what was in it, that kind of thing. But the Emir actually invited me over to his treasury, and as far as I could see, there was nothing wrong with the cash in the treasury. He said, well, there's £1,000 missing, and the Mudir al-Mal, as he was called, the treasurer, is in the prison. So I had a look at the... So some clerk produced this thing. So I had a look at the bank statement, and I found that what had happened was that the £1,000, which, again, converted into 30,000 now, because we're talking of 40 years ago, £1,000, which had been paid from the British agency in Aden to the Emirate of Dala, had in fact been paid into the Emirate of Behar. And so it was quite right, the Emir, who was good on figures, he was £1,000 out. And so I said, well, I know who's got it. The Sharif of Behar got it. And the idea of getting £1,000 out of the Sharif of Behar pleased him enormously. I don't think we got £1,000 out of the Sharif of Behar, but I know we got £1,000 out of the bank in Aden. I mean, they had to admit that they'd made a mistake. So ever afterwards, the Emir was very keen, always, that I should inspect his treasury in the hopes that I might find another £1,000. And the treasurer was allowed release from prison. The other one I liked was another occasion I was checking his treasury. Part of his treasury wasn't in the form of cash. It was in the form of corn, because some of the taxes were paid in the form of corn. Ashur, I think it's called, a tenth. And the corn is stored underground in a cavern called a mudfan. And I was warned that you don't just lift the great stone that goes over this cavern. If you go in, there's a shortage of air inside and you'll be asphyxiated. So it's very difficult to check the thing, really, because you have to lift the stone and let the cavern breathe for the best part of a day before you can go in there, which of course means that all sorts of things can be done in the meantime. Well, because when you get inside, you just see piles of corn, the foggiest idea what's there. I took one of my Arab assistants down with me. I said, well, Abdullah, what do you think? Why do you know? There were so many kaddas, which is a measurement of volume of corn there. So, when I came up, I told the Emir, I said, Abdullah says there are only 150 kaddas of corn there, and according to the books, there ought to be about 300 or something. The Emir says, well, I expect my horses to eat. That was that. Sharfel, as Godfrey may have told us, very fond of his horses, because he had a sort of withered leg. That was from birth. So if he was going any distance, he had to ride. He was quite a good horseman, too. Really, most of my time in Dala was spent... stamping my foot as much as anything. I had a...
How do you mean?
Well, I had a battalion of levies, and I have at times I had a whole British battalion up there. I had my own. I had the Kersal Eye up there for months or two. And if you've got a lot of troops there, as the commanders, colonels in charge of these regiments said, look, you must keep them occupied. And so I used to keep them occupied on sort of cordon and search operation, that sort of thing.
What did that involve?
You surround a village before first light, and then you send the government guards in to search for arms. And if anyone provokes a fight, you assume they're on the wrong side. That didn't often happen. They weren't they weren't that stupid.
But you mean you really did that just to keep them occupied?
Well, also it kept the country quiet. I mean, it showed that we were in charge. The other thing is one of the things that Lugard says in Dual Mandate is that the government must tax as an indication that it is in charge. And there were two areas of Dala. One was round the back of the Jahaf called Fijra. And they said that they feared to bring the tax round because it meant going round the base of the Jahaf very close to the Yemeni border, and they couldn't bring the tax in. This is in the form of corn from there. So I took lorries round and a large military expedition, and we collected that lot. Well, then the other people who said they couldn't bring down the tax were the people way up in the mountains, the Jebel Harir. And so I took camels up there and brought their tax in. The other people who said they weren't going to pay any tax were actually out of my range. And do you remember that book of Evelyn Waugh's? It's either, I think it's Black Mischief. Do you know Black Mischief? Well, somewhere in Black Mischief, it says that it had been found in the Empire of Azania that prudent to combine the offices of Master General of the Ordnance and Commissioner for Inland Revenue, and in effect, power flows from the barrel of a field gun. And so the particular area was called the Mafari Plateau. Now, the emir was, one of his wives, I think, was a daughter of the Mafari Sheikh. And I couldn't get at the Mafari Sheikh, but I thought, well, I think he's just within range of Tom Fletcher's 75mm guns. They had a range of about 9,000 yards. And so I said to the emir, well, tell the Mafari Sheikh that I'm going to demonstrate my ability to close his road. Because the Mafari Plateau, it was a little lost world, with steep sides, a plateau all around it, and a path sort of zigzagging down the side. And I took the guns up into Zala, and I said, Tom, do you reckon that path is within range? He said, yes, I think it is. So we sent a signal to the, a messenger to the Mafari Sheikh, and said, keep your people off that pass, because we're going to make a few bangs on that. we fired half a dozen shells at best against the side of the plateau, beside the path, indicate that they wouldn't be able to come down if we wanted to stop them. And sure enough, the text came in from the Mafari Plateau, one up to Evelyn Waugh. But otherwise, this large area, there was one particularly large area called where the Azrakis lived, Azarak. We'd never got the tax in from there, and we never got the tax in from Zubayat either. There was a Tarsan man called Seyd Afif up there. And those areas remained beyond my control for the, 18 months or so that I was in Zala. I drew up schemes for a sort of military reoccupation of the area, but they didn't find favour in Aden, so I didn't do anything about it.
Sounds as though they were more or less independent then.
Well, they didn't pay tax, to put it that way. I suffered about impudence from a chap down that way. He was to come and shoot at my house. And
with a rifle?
Yes, oh, quite harmless. As Travaskis put it, he said it's the local equivalent of a letter to the Times. But it is completely harmless, but it blackens your face. You mustn't allow it. You mustn't let people shoot at your house.
So how do you stop it?
Well, as I'm about to tell you. So, nothing in Arabia happens, because there were so few people, nothing in Arabia happens without somebody knowing who did it. I mean, where's in England or Nigeria, somebody commits a murder, and the problem is to find out who did it. Once you know who did it, the problem of picking them up is not very great. In Arabia, numerous people will know who did it and why. The problem is to catch him, because he's over the frontier. Well, in this case, I soon had evidence as to who did it. And I can't remember the name. Anyway, he came from an area that was outside my control. But I had one of the Emir's old guards called Ali Askar, who knew where everybody lived. He'd worked for Hydra in his day. And I took Ali Askar and an interpreter up in a little single Pioneer, one of those little aircraft that can land on a postage stamp. And we got Ali Askar to point out where this fellow's house was. And then the Pioneer apparently couldn't photograph the house, but a meteor came up took photographs of this house, and they were brought down within the following day. These photographs were there, and Ali Askar confirmed, yes, we've got the right house. And I had the photographs on my table in my office, so that anyone that came in could see that I'm capable of photographing houses here, there, and elsewhere. And we then wrote a letter to this chap saying that if you don't strike a more reverential attitude towards the assistant advisor, Dala, I'm afraid that we will not hold ourselves responsible for the consequences. Well, this didn't have the desired effect. He came and shot at my house a couple of nights later. So I then sent a signal down to Aden saying, at your convenience, pray destroy sort of target XYZ, which had all been registered. And then the following morning, when the light was good, early in the morning, you hear whoom, 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 as the rockets went in. And again, before the day was out, the RAF intelligence officer had photographs showing the destruction this house, but also conveniently put onto my office table and were available for anyone to see. Well, however, this fellow didn't give up, a determined character, and he went off to his father-in-law's house. His father-in-law lived in a district called Holmain. And I don't remember photographing his house, but I sent him a letter saying that afraid your son-in-law is a bad hap, and he's lost his own house, and be too sure what might happen to yours if he persists in this activity. His father-in-law would have passed the message on, and after that there was no more shooting at the political officer's house. And I say the thing was quite harmless, because my house was very solid, and subsequently was bazookaed and all sorts of things without any injury coming to people. But it was the principle of the thing was that you mustn't be allowed, you mustn't allow people to shoot at your house.
You mean bazookaed after you'd gone?
Oh, long, yes. Oh, I mean, this was, you haven't spoken to Peter, but when Peter Hinchcliffe was there and Brian Summerfield, oh, yes, I mean, this is when the dissidents were far better on. You see, in my day, the enemy, these people bribed by the Yemen, I mean, they only had the rifles they had were these Italian 1896 what do you call them, Mossada. They were six
Martini
shooters.
Henry.
Not quite. No, they were Italian, and they I think they were called Mossadas or something. They were six shooters. They were very long, and I think the Italians had probably given them to the Yemeni army before the war, because the Italians had rather stirred up the Yemenis before the war against us. And they probably, these rifles were probably given to the Yemeni army by the Italians before the Second War. The Yemeni army was probably, by my day, being equipped with Russian things. I mean, they had a few T-34 tanks, and they had, the other thing the Yemenis had, they had those heavy Russian machine guns on wheels. They fired. I can show you one. They fired a 0.5 bullet, and their rate of fire was sort of bang, 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 almost the rate of a Bofors gun. They were very slow, very long range, of course. But they were cumbersome things, literally on wheels. But that was on the Yemeni side, the front. The dissidents had nothing but small arms, whereas we had, of course, we had the old Abu Hashab, the Mark III, which is what my guards had. But we also had Bren guns, 3-inch mortars, and we had these two 75mm mountain guns, which, as I say, were a range of about 9,000 yards. We could also call on the air. We had these Venoms, which fired these 60-pound squash head rockets, and lots of cannon, sort of, well, you know, what is it, 20mm cannons, I think the fighter aircraft used to have in those days. And the other thing that made the warfare, if you can call it that, of those days fairly light-hearted was the fact that the enemy didn't have any mines in those days. The armoured cars that I had were, I think they were 13th, 18th Hussars. They had a squadron over in Bahraimi, I think it was, you know, the other corner of Arabia. And they knew all about mines because the American oil company, Aramco, used to supply the Saudis with mines in order to embarrass our forces. And at least I think it was the Americans who supplied them. We had no mine problem in Zala. Our enemy was ill-equipped, really, to deal with us. We didn't have a great deal of trouble. The Rad Fan in my day was interesting compared with what it subsequently became. In some weird theory of the emirs, that in some respect he was Lord of Rad Fan. My tribesmen, as he called them. Well, the emir Haider may have had some clout in Rad Fan. There was no question of him taxing the Rad Fan as in. Rad Fan was in between Dala and Lahij and Aden, you see. And the Kataibi was entitled to duties on the goods that went up the so-called Holy Road from Aden up to Gartaba through Alawi, Lahij, Haushabi, Rad Fan, and Dala. Five people were entitled to customs. And I think they were all collected in Lahij. And the emir got his fifth of the thing, and also the Kataibi free. Well, about every other month, when there was what we call a Dala convoy, and the British company, was switched over. We used to have a great demonstration on the Dala Road with picketing of all the heights and venoms whizzing up and down and armoured cars and all the rest of it. When the one British company went down, the other British company went up. And I used to take that opportunity to go down under cover of all this military activity and spend the night in the fort at Thumir, which was a government guard fort. The commander of the fort was always a Katabi in order to sort of keep the Katabis quiet. And the Katabi sheikh used to come in and see me. If he didn't, I thought, well, he's got an evil conscience about something. I wonder what's wrong. And he'd receive a prison, a box of ammunition, or 1,000 rounds or something.